This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. The struggle in the South over unionization provoked violence and divided families across the region. And that fight was no different here in North Carolina. In towns like Roanoke Rapids, the mills controlled working life, and workers were often afraid to organize for fear of losing their jobs. But in the 1970s, they formed coalitions that transcended race and gender to fight for their rights. Joey Fink joins the program now to tell us about the history of unionization in North Carolina. She's a PhD candidate, in history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Joey Fink, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Roanoke Rapids and unionization. You're looking at what is now a very famous story up there, right?
That's right. The story formed the basis for the Academy Award-winning movie Norma Rae. But it goes back. From the 70s. There were a couple of organizing drives in Roanoke Rapids in the 1960s. The union lost an election in 1965. The National Labor Relations Board later ruled that that election couldn't stand because the company had, quote, terrorized and harassed pro-union workers. So in 1973, the Textile Workers Union of America sent another organizer to Roanoke Rapids to try again. And in August of 1974, they won an election, voting for the union to represent them in collective bargaining.
We're going to hold the story right there just to lay the groundwork a little bit. And just the idea that you would even hold a vote to start a union, organize a union in North Carolina, was in some ways a very dangerous thing. This was not hospitable territory for unions.
That's right, and the people in Roanoke Rapids knew that very well. Several workers had been fired in the 60s for standing for the union. They had been reinstated with back pay. But one of the things about back pay is that companies were allowed to write it off as a tax, as a business expense. One labor activist estimated that J.P. Stevens saved about $35,000 by using back pay as
a
tax write-off.
Well, and these are some of the sort of the subterranean right supports for business that actually tip the balance in favor of the owners over and against the workers, that you don't even see that labor law in these small ways will favor the company.
That's right. That's why it was so important in the 1970s, after the election victory, that the union get a lot of broad public support and make people aware of what was going on. And they did that largely because of the people on the ground in Roanoke Rapids. Crystal Lee was just one of them, who stood up and told their stories very well, very poignantly, and very evocatively.
Crystal Lee Sutton, of course, who's the real person who then became Norma Rae in the movies. So talk about the conditions at that J.P. Stevens factory.
Well, workers there, I would use a term popular in labor history, were fighting for bread and roses. Their bread was better wages. In North Carolina, textile workers made, on average, about $1.60 less an hour than most manufacturers in the country. Wages were far lower in North Carolina, period, because of low unionization rates. Their other bread was equal opportunity. Lucy Sledge was an African-American mill worker who filed a class action lawsuit against J.P. Stevens for discriminating against her based on both her race and gender. Women were also concerned about things like seniority, particularly not losing it after maternity leave. And they were worried about safer working conditions. But their roses, and I think this is what really drew people in, it was being treated with respect and decency. And they told really powerful anecdotes to express this. For instance, they talked a lot about bathrooms, especially the women. Maureen Hedgepeth, who was a white working class woman in Roanoke Rapids, talked about how in the 1960s, J.P. Stevens took a bench out of the women's bathroom. The women they resented this. They saw it as J.P. Stevens controlling something that should be private, a private space for them. Other women talked about how bathroom breaks were monitored, and it was really embarrassing to have to explain to your boss why you had to use the bathroom more often if you were, say, pregnant or having some womanly troubles. And they saw it as an invasion of privacy. Bathrooms were a space where women could talk freely, maybe talk about the union, and to have their breaks monitored or to be surveyed while they were in there. They saw as a affront to their dignity.
Right. And the point is you would have to answer that question. Why were you in there so long? Why have you taken so many breaks? You're working here, and this is the deal. You have no deal.
Exactly.
Right? You're working with us. And brown lung disease, of course, was another important health consideration. This is from breathing in the cotton dust and fibers. And, of course, it relates to black lung disease, which is from coal mines. Here's something you could get in a factory. And so we have someone here who I think is from the archive of the Southern Oral History Archive, right? And her name, we don't have her name, but she's testifying in Greenville, South Carolina, before several senators, talking about her family working in the mills.
My mother, my stepfather, my husband, my sister, and myself all had to quit the mill because of a breathing problem. As long as the textile manufacturers are able to scare politicians and to buy them off with liquor and campaign contributions, they ain't going to do much to help the poor working people of this state.
So, and talk about brown lung disease and the fact that it took so long to even acknowledge it. And, of course, again, the factories had no responsibility at all to do anything about it, right?
Well, that's an interesting statement that it took so long to acknowledge it. The textile manufacturers were talking about brown lung as early as the 1940s in their own correspondence with each other. But it was really hard to get a diagnosis for brown lung, particularly from the doctor that the company employed on site. So the Carolina Brown Lung Association formed to help workers get tested, get diagnosed, and get compensation. What was interesting about the Carolina Brown Lung Association was because it was organizing older workers who were by definition no longer employed by the union, or excuse me, by the company, it lent a different kind of urgency and legitimacy to the claims. While the union was organizing active workers, younger people, these were women like we just heard, older white women, usually white because there were fewer African-American workers in the mills prior to the 60s, church leaders. They were women who were known in their communities as good, upright church women, and they were getting up and they were lambasting politicians and owners in their own words, on their own terms, and in very effective ways.
Is this part of it? Because this leads to the next question, which is it's been very hard to organize unions in North Carolina. And then finally, in 1973 at the J.P. Stevens plant in Roanoke Rapids, we get a vote in favor of unions. What was going on in 73? What changed?
Mm-hmm. Well, the organizing drive started in 73 and the election was won in 1974. I would say, well, some labor historians have argued that there were some sort of structural things at work. The company had taken away its profit-sharing program that angered white and black workers alike. I would say a couple of things, though, we need to think about historically. There was a lot of energy coming out of the 1960s, coming out of the social movements, the civil rights movement, energy for anti-poverty activism, for workers' rights. And there were a lot of activists who saw the next step of the civil rights movement, the next step towards making America more just and equitable, happening among working class, black and white working class people standing together. And I think Roanoke Rapids was a place where there was already a lot of pro-union sentiment that had been repressed and silenced through illegal means. And it came up in 73 and 74, and they finally got the victory that they might have had back in the 60s if they hadn't.
And race had always been used very effectively as a wedge to keep workers separated and to keep that kind of leverage from overwhelming the owners. Here, apparently by the 1970s, workers in Roanoke Rapids anyway were able to bridge that divide?
It does seem so. There was about 30% African Americans in the workforce in Roanoke Rapids. So clearly, to win a majority in the election, you needed to have white support. I think that there were some really effective on-the-ground leaders, African American men and women, who organized to bridge that distance. And I think that there were people like Crystal Lee, who would refer to herself as colorblind, who just refused to be intimidated or afraid of what might happen if they, say, went to a union meeting at a black Baptist church.
And so all of these elements are coming together. And as you said, the civil rights movement is moving into a new phase. And religious progressives also played mm-hmm. a part. In fact, there's a fairly interesting story about an infiltration at the plant, right?
That's right. There was significant religious support for this campaign. The Southerners for Economic Justice worked to get local churches to either support the union or, if they didn't support the union, to at least remain neutral. And there was one story I found that I'm actually very eager to learn more about, of two nuns who went undercover in a hosiery mill in the South. They were eventually discovered, but they went in to talk to the women firsthand, to document firsthand what was going on in these mills.
Obviously not wearing their habits, because that would give you away pretty quickly. But it's an interesting story. And again, these coalitions all coming together around the 1970s. So race had been used as an effective way to create a wedge. Now gender is an important thing. And I want to play a bit of an interview that you did with Charlotte Brody, talking about the way they tried to smear her because she was involved in union activism.
Around midnight, somebody comes knocking on my door. That there was an assumption that a woman alone in a hotel in Statesboro, Georgia, was a traveling prostitute. And maybe somebody who worked for the mill told that story on purpose. But I had, a guy wondering why I wouldn't let him in. I was terrified. Right? So,
jeez.
And when I called the front desk, they weren't helpful at all, right? It was like I didn't speak the language. It was bad. But I put a chair up against the door and didn't sleep much that night. But again, it was sexual politics, right? They didn't try to beat me up.
Talk more about that sexual politics and the way the companies would use gender than as a way to discredit union workers.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a long history of that in American labor history. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, any women working for public wages or making demands for change in the public arena was vulnerable to accusations of sexual deviance. By the 1970s, this still holds true, as we hear from Charlotte Brody. You can sort of try to put yourself in her shoes. You're stuck in a hotel room. That door is the only way in or out. And there's a strange man. He might bust down the door. What are you going to do? So women did risk a lot. They risked damages to their reputation or even to their personal selves. For someone like Crystal Lee, the company and anti-union workers didn't have to make up rumors. She did have what one might call a checkered past. But what she did was she got out in front of it. She told her story before anyone could try to use it against her. And that, as many people will agree, was incredibly brave. But it also wasn't unheard of in the 1970s. It was a time of great change and flux in the way that men and women related to each other and what a good woman could be or do or say or have in her past.
Well, and even that, I mean, even the assumption that her sexual behavior is somehow deviant and male sexual behavior on the same order is not reflects the sexual politics inherent in this struggle.
Exactly. Right? I had one activist say, when men are for the union, they're communists or radicals. When women are, they're the sluts who sleep with them.
And this goes back a long way, because even if we see in the post-Civil War era, as African-American families start making great strides, building wealth and threatening the whole underpinning of first slavery and then later on Jim Crow, we're going to start to see stories arise about the myth of the hypersexualized black male that helps keep poor blacks and poor whites divided.
And you do see anxieties around desegregation. You have to remember desegregation in many ways was still playing out in the 70s in southern towns and in southern workplaces. So as you have the breakdown of the traditional barriers that so-called protected people, you also had women like Crystal Lee who were bucking the tradition of what a good woman was supposed to be.
And this was even in the 70s, as you said, when things were changing, still a pretty serious problem. We've got a clip from a 1974 documentary about Crystal Lee Sutton.
I had one woman tell me, she was an older white woman that came out of Rump Number 2 Mill. I asked if she would please sign a union card. And my son, he was having to leave it that day, and he said, "Ma'am," said, "did you sign that union card?" And she said, "I just threw it away." I said, "Ma'am, you just threw away your life." She turned around, she said, "What's your name?" I said, "Crystal Jordan." She said, "I've been wanting to meet you." She said, "I sure do feel sorry for you, because of any woman that has little enough respect for herself to do what you did." And I assume she meant by telling my story like it was to my children. And I told her, I said, "Ma'am," I said, "please don't feel sorry for me." And I pointed to my son, I said, "and that's my son, and I love him."
Here's a movement that is pulling together a lot of the threads that had sort of been organized on separate paths in the 60s, women's rights, workers' rights, and racial equality. Did it have that effect? This particular were those movements sort of pulled together in a kind of one large orbit, or not?
I would argue that they were, at least within the J.P. Stevens campaign. And I would credit that a lot to the white and African-American working class women who told their stories, because their stories represented the intersection of all of the different struggles that these various activists and movements were struggling against. Gender-based discrimination, race-based discrimination, poverty, low wages, low opportunities for advancement. These were all connected in their stories, and they were told in a way that made them real instead of abstract, visceral instead of seeming far away or disconnected from everyday life.
So let's talk about the impact short-term and long-term of the Union victory in 74.
Well, in the short term, the company agreed to negotiate a contract at all of the sites where the Union had won an election. So Roanoke Rapids got its contract in 1981. And the Union was there until the last plant closed in 2003. In the long run, we all probably know the story of what happened. Mills started closing down, manufacturing went overseas, and the unions were not going to be able to stop that, no matter what they had done, whether they were in or out. And I think most workers understand this, that with or without a union, no one was going to compete with a worker who was going to work for 20 cents an hour somewhere else.
You know, but that's what the owners will say, that the unions and organized labor brought this on themselves, that their demands simply made them uncompetitive and forced the owners to seek cheaper inputs abroad.
That's certainly an argument that they could and sometimes did make. But oddly enough, in the 1980s, a lot of the textile union leaders and textile manufacturers were on the same side fighting for protective tariff and trade laws that would protect manufacturing. And certainly when NAFTA happened, that just blew it all out of the water.
And it's a quality of life question. It's how low do you want your quality of – how much do you want to degrade your quality of life to keep a job that is now not paying bills and allowing you to live the same lifestyle as – in those developing countries. So but what's the long term? Where are we today in all of this? Is there any kind of legacy, or was it a dead end?
Well, I do think that there is a legacy. Sometimes it can be hard from where we sit to see the past as something that was full of possibilities. So first of all, we have to keep in mind that in 1980, the many Norma Rays who fought in that campaign, that was a victory for them. The African-American men and women, many of whom were fired, like Crystal Lee was, it was a victory for them. They made history. No union had done before what they did. And in very personal ways, women since have told their stories of being involved in that campaign and how it affected them. Mary Robinson was an African-American woman from Montgomery, Alabama, who worked in the Stevens Mills there. And she said, "When I started this campaign, I was just a little old black girl from Alabama. Stevens made me a woman." You can interpret that a lot of different ways, but clearly she took something from her involvement in that mattered a lot to her.
Is there any sign of it today? Any sign of those coalitions that exist today and that might have that kind of impact today?
I do think so. One of the things that these coalition supporters of the union, like Southerners for Economic Justice, did in the 1970s, they focused on community networks, not the traditional labor laws and institutions of organized labor that we think of, but churches, community centers. And when manufacturing left the country, as it did, and a lot of those institutions and places of activism left with it, what was left were churches and community centers where activists had long been working. And I think we see it going on today. Southerners for Economic Justice was involved in the efforts to organize housekeepers at UNC. The workers at Smithfield, the food packaging place, they were using a lot of community networks to overcome racial and ethnic barriers. So there is a legacy alive today.
Joey, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joey Fink is a PhD candidate in history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's going to give a talk on her research tomorrow at 12:30 at the Love House on UNC's campus. And for more information, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Up next, the importance of early childhood literacy. Please stay with us.